The Hayes Advantage with Kathleen Hayes.
Dennis Gartman, economist and editor of the Gartman Letter. And he and I have been talking for years. Dennis, of course, has traded just about everything under the sun. Bonds out of the CBOT, which is now the CME, of course. And now one of the best-known commodities analysts, investors. Many people read his letter and follow it, including all of us, I think, here at Bloomberg. Dennis, welcome.
Thank you for having me on. It was nice to hear Sarah, one of my good friends in the business. I always did. Always enjoy hearing her talk.
Very sharp, very sharp, very thorough.
Absolutely.
Yes, indeed. I can only agree. Regarding this rating downgrade, I guess, right? How big of a deal? Obviously, it surprised the markets, but how big of a deal?
I'm not sure it's a great deal at all. I mean, it was just from AA to AA-, no big deal. But I think one of my lines in the business is there's never just one cockroach. I.e., when things change, they usually have started a new change, and that new change goes for a long period of time. This is probably the first of a great number of revisions downward in the ratings for Japan. There won't be another one for several months. Might not be one for a quarter or two, but this is the first, and there are many more to come. And I think that's what's important. But the first one, no big deal. More important that we're trading at or near 83 yen to the dollar, which for the technicians out there becomes a very important number.
Because
that starts to break some downtrend lines that go back for a long period of time. It also starts to change. If you look at yen versus other currencies, yen versus Canada, yen versus Aussie, yen versus the euro, you start to break some trend lines that exist there that are probably going to unleash even more yen selling. So it's an important technical position. It's an important, for lack of a better term, mental and philosophical position.
Okay, and as you point out, could be more downgrades, but they started from a pretty decent level. But, you know, the yen's had gotten pretty strong, though, right?
So, well, it had been over the course of the past year, but what's interesting is it has not made new highs. It stopped making new highs, and it started to make recently lower lows relative to the dollar. The dollar started to make higher highs relative to the yen, whichever way you want to think of it in those terms. And a currency that stops making new highs and starts to break trend lines, one needs to pay attention to it. So I think one should be if one wants to trade, one should be a seller of the yen without equivocation.
Yeah, I guess what I'm trying to say is, so from a trading standpoint, that's important. But when you've had this big move up, that maybe it's not like we have to get all scared and freaked out about a weak yen right now.
I don't think you have to get all freaked out about a weak yen. But if you're a trader, to me, it looks like the
sure.
kind of trade that has
absolutely.
Merit to it.
And you can make money by going the other direction.
That's correct.
Now, more broadly, this whole, we're all now sort of focused on debt. I think one of the interesting questions about Japan, Sarah said all the reasons why their rates are still so low. I mean, come on, they have some of the lowest rates in the world. So quite apart from the fact that domestic investors own the bonds, is it also because the world sort of says to itself, this government's not going to default on its debt?
Oh, Japan will not default on its debt, or at least not in my lifetime. That's not going to happen, okay? And it is important. What Sarah brought up is an absolutely important circumstance. Comparing who owns Japan's debt to who owns Greece's debt or who owns Spain's debt are demonstrably different circumstances. All of, and my wife always says, never use the word all, but 97% of Japanese debt is held in Japanese hands. What is it? I think 65%, and don't hold me to that number, but it's probably pretty close, of Greek's debt is held outside of Greece. That's a completely different circumstance. Money can run away from Greece. Money probably isn't going to run away from Japan because the Japanese themselves are the major holders.
Well, a little closer to home, the Federal Reserve had its meeting yesterday, and there were certainly
Did
no...
Did they meet yesterday?
They met Tuesday and Wednesday.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, I know. And they didn't say much, but the statement, I would say, Dennis, that came out of it was, okay, maybe the economy's getting better, but, you know, unemployment's still way too high.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe manufacturers are investing more, but, you know, housing's still weak. Very, very dovish statement to me. That's what it seems like.
I couldn't agree more. I saw nothing in any of the statements that came out, nothing in any of the statements from regional presidents, nothing in any statements from the governors going into the meeting in the previous several weeks that would indicate anything other than, we're holding rates steady. We have no intention of raising the overnight Fed funds rate for a long period of time into the future. I can remember when we first got to 0%, it's been almost 2 years now, and I told people in my newsletter that we probably wouldn't move the overnight Fed funds rate until at least 2011. This was 2009 when I made that statement. It looked laughable at the time. Well, here we are, 2011, and I don't think at least for the next 6 months, probably for the next 9 months, and maybe even for the next 12 months, does the Fed have any intention of changing its overnight Fed funds rate. I think also what we have to understand, I find it interesting, people say, well, inflationary concerns are driving the back end of the yield curve up. Isn't that disconcerting? And my response is, you know what? I actually think the Fed is happy to see the back end of the yield curve rise. It makes the curve far more positively sloped, and nothing does more to aid the banking system than a positively sloped yield curve.
Ah, yes. Shades of the 90s.
Shades of the 90s. As I say, nothing helps. A positively sloped yield curves turn banking idiots into geniuses in a long-term period of time.
So what about commodities and the Fed? Because there's a lot of discussion, debate, analysis of, it's real simple to say, quantitative easing, the hot money goes overseas, we're fueling food inflation in other countries. And then there's the argument, no, not exactly. There's a lot of excess reserves in our country. You really can't blame the Fed, et cetera. What does Dennis Gartman say?
Well, my first response to that is, well, yes, of course, grain prices have been going up. Commodity prices generally have been going up. I'm not sure it's a direct response to what the Fed has done. In fact, I argue that if you look at what the Fed has done since October of 2009, the adjusted monetary base, which to me is the stock from which all other monetary aggregates are derived, the monetary base is actually negative over the last 13 or 14 months. There has been no growth in the monetary aggregates.
Dennis, one of my listeners has been noting that, for example, commodities and commodity stocks are strong, and that's based on strong demand from emerging markets. But a lot of the BRIC stock indexes, right, Shanghai and Brazil, have been weak due to concern about inflation and tightening. There's this big disparity. Who's going to notice it first, commodities? Emerging market stocks, what's going on?
Well, it is interesting, isn't it, that the Bovespa in Brazil is down rather materially from its highs, not just a correction. It looks far more serious than a mere short-term correction. On the other hand, most commodity prices have been going from the lower left to the upper right, so that dichotomy is there. I think that the BRIC stock markets, with the exception of China, got a little overdone last year. We do forget that the strongest stock markets in the world last year, Indonesia, I think, was the strongest. Philippines, if I'm not mistaken, certainly in the top two or three. Brazil was strong until about November. The only one of those markets that was weak for most of last year was China. But most of the BRIC markets were very strong. I think they're having a rational, reasonable correction relative to that. If I'm not mistaken, I don't have the data in front of me, but Indonesia was up almost 40%. It's down about 7% thus far. Probably corrective in nature. I'm a little concerned, though, about what I see going on in Brazil. That may be a reaction to the fact that Lula, who we got very comfortable with, who was a leftist in name only and ruled from the right, has given over to a new president who in her youth was an avowed Marxist, who has tried to convince us that she's not nearly as left-wing as her rhetoric has been. But I think there's enough concern that maybe she is, that some money has moved away from Brazil. Brazil may be an unusual circumstance just because of the politics involved.
Well, that's true. Although Lula da Silva started out as very, very much on the left. And for Fernando Cardoso, you know, was actually kind of that sort of Latin American Marxist himself. So they all seem to sort of move more to the center because they had to.
They have to.
Dennis, on the question of food prices, escalating food prices, are they going to cause more civil unrest in Africa and elsewhere?
I think they are. I think there's something really important going on in Africa. This sounds like a return to the days of the 1960s when I was at university, but we have the domino theory is in effect again. Tunisia fell in a very short span of time after just a series of protests about a month ago. suddenly a government that looked fully entrenched in power toppled. Now you have food riots, for lack of a better term, taking place in Egypt. There are also some concerns now that there are problems taking place in Yemen, which probably should be, there probably should be problems there. I wouldn't be surprised if we see the same sorts of food riots, political dissension taking place in the not-too-distant future in Libya. What we're seeing is the advent of rebellion or revolution going across the Arab nations, I think, spread by the fact that communications are so much swifter nowadays. As I've written in my newsletter, we have to remember the Tiananmen Square circumstance evolved over the fax machine. That was then the form of transmission of information. We've obviously gone past that to an even more swifter internet, and now you're starting to see one country after another see the regimes topple. So call it food to start it, but I think there's rationality and reason why these regimes, one after another, are going to start falling down. We may all want to applaud the fact that Libya might topple, that Egypt might topple. We might applaud that eventually Iran might topple, but you also have to remember into that sort of chaos and confusion, you have to be careful what you get. As H.L. Mencken said, be careful what you wish for. You just might get it good and hard.
Why are food prices rising so rapidly now? You seem to not put so much emphasis on the link between the Fed, quantitative easing, and in food inflation. Many have. How much is it that? And if it's not that, is it more weather? Because this is such a marked, sudden event.
I think there's something well beyond a Federal Reserve or monetary officials around the world stimulating economic growth and commodity prices or grain prices going up. There is a real problem in the global grain supply. Last year, we knew that the Russian crop, the wheat crop in Russia, the wheat crop in Kazakhstan, and the wheat crop also in Ukraine, for all intents and purposes, had been destroyed. I mean, there was some crop available, but it had really, really been diminished, taking Russia from being an exporter of grain to being a net importer of grain. The world had hoped, the grain markets of the world had hoped, that Australia, which is the next big winter wheat crop that comes to fruition, would fill the void that Russia had left behind. But now we all know what happened to the northeast coast and the southeast coast of Australia with enormous rains and cyclones, and suddenly that wheat crop really has been destroyed. It is now not edible. It is merely feed grain usage. So Australia has been taken out, and the grain market is extraordinarily tight, and demand is really quite strong. So you have a reduction in supply and an increase in demand, which is driving grain prices higher. That has nothing to do with the Federal Reserve Bank. It has everything to do with Mother Nature and with stronger economies around the world.
We first talked about food inflation, but when it starts spurring political unrest, and it's interesting, Dennis, I've seen some headlines running across the Bloomberg terminal from a former President Bill Clinton saying how, you know, Tunisia, Egypt, in Yemen, these people are yearning to join the modern era. And it's interesting how it could take something like, I guess people just get to the point where if they can't buy their bread, that's it.
That's exactly what goes on. All autocrats always fear concerns about rising food prices. And the Chinese, although they're not having a problem right now, every Chinese leader knows that major upheavals in China have always been predicated upon food inflation through the centuries. And the same thing has taken place across northern Africa. These things are not going to go away anytime soon. And I think what it does do is when people get angry, when people get hungry, they tend to overthrow governments almost on a whim. The manner in which Tunisia fell as swiftly as it did had to send a signal to every autocratic regime across northern Africa and on into the Middle East. I'm afraid that if I were one of those leaders, I would make certain that my military was topped up and taken care of, because I'm going to be very concerned about the population rising up and saying, we've had enough.
What can they do about higher food prices? What can they quote-unquote do, right?
Yeah, I mean, not much that they can do, actually, Kathleen, can they? I mean, it's out of their hands. The Chinese, every once in a while, have tried to release grain stocks to keep food prices in the inner parts of China from rising, But as soon as they do that, they have to go back out into the world market and restock their stocks. The same thing is taking place in Africa. There's really not much they can do about it. And I think now that the broad public has seen in Egypt how quickly Tunisia fell, and if they're hungry, they're going to topple the Mubarak regime relatively quickly.
Let's run through a list of some of the, let's do a little speed round here on commodities. You just said wheat could get easily to $10.
Yes.
Let's run through, I'll give you a list and you tell me what you think. What about corn?
Corn prices are clearly going higher. The fundamentals in corn are probably even stronger than are the fundamentals in the wheat market. Can corn prices get to $7 a bushel? Yeah, I think it's very easy.
Okay. Soybeans.
Well, we've got beans in the teens already, and the streets in Chicago, when you and I were living in Chicago, that was one of the great chants that would go up every once in a while. The entire city of Chicago feels better when beans were in the teens back in the old days. Beans are probably going to get to the middle teens. I'm not as bullish of the bean market in percentage terms as I would be of corn or wheat, but bean prices are probably going higher.
How about rice?
If there really is a market that wants to go higher, we have to remember that is the world's most important grain. More people eat rice on a daily basis than anything else other than wheat. And the fundamentals of the rice market are really quite strong. If I'm going to err upon anything, I'm going to err upon rice. It's a little more difficult for Americans to trade. We do have a rice futures, but it's not terribly liquid and it's not terribly deep. I would like to make it more liquid and I would like to think it would get deeper.
Cattle and hogs, we're seeing pork soaring today, one of my favorite meats, I must say, because of hoof and mouth disease in Korea, right?
I didn't see that headline, but even without that, over the course of the past several months, those livestock prices have been moving extremely high, taking out almost historic levels. So I'm a little less bullish at these prices. You can substitute for beef and you can substitute for pork relatively quickly and go down to chicken prices, go down to fish. So I'm not nearly as bullish of livestock prices as I would be of grains.
Okay. What about your favorite sector in commodities right now?
Well, the one that really has caught everybody by surprise is the unbelievable strength in the cotton market. I grew up in the cotton business. That was my first job out of undergraduate school at my beloved NC State back in the early 1970s. And for me, it's just hard. Once cotton got above a dollar, I stood back in awe of the majesty of that bull market. Here we are now trading at $1.70. These are prices triple and quadruple what I would have ever thought we could get cotton to. But you've had a destruction of the crop in Pakistan for all intents and purposes. The Indian cotton crop has been severely impinged. We need to grow as much cotton as we can. The problem is we had such low prices for such a long time that we actually lost a lot of gins here in the United States. We lost a lot of cotton pickers, the machinery needed to pick cotton, and you need several years of high prices to get farmers to rebuild their gins, to make a co-op of some sort, or to go out and spend the money to buy the machinery. Cotton is an extremely intensive crop to grow. And wheat, for example, you can put wheat in the ground and almost do anything to it, and as long as you get adequate rains, it'll grow. As long as with corn you get reasonable amounts of nitrogen applied to the crop and rains, it'll grow. Cotton, however, you have to hold its hand. Once you get a good crop, it's astonishing what you can do. But to me, to see $1.75 cotton is just absolutely mind-numbing.
Okay. And, of course, we've got a headline crossing on the terminal that recent rains in Argentina's main corn-growing area is not enough to improve crops affected by earlier dry weather. That's according to the Buenos Aires Cereals Exchange.
Yeah, they've had droughts down there for a long period of time. They need a lot more rain, okay. And they're seemingly not getting it.
Dennis, how about farmland as an asset?
You know, I have a hard time, Kathleen, with real estate. I really don't understand real estate because it's hard to. I live in a world of mark to market, and where the bid offer is tight, and I have difficulty understanding why anybody would want to own real estate. Nonetheless, that being said, if you're going to own any land that grows good crops, land that can grow $7 corn, land that grows $13, $14, $15 soybeans, land in the Mid-South that grows $1.50 cotton, clearly is land that's going to be more valuable next year than it is this year.
My guest is Dennis Gartman, editor of the Gartman Letter. Dennis, gold. You said in your newsletter recently you were ready to accept gold prices at $1,320 an ounce. Does that mean you're ready to buy at these levels?
Not yet. I had been bullish of gold for a long period of time, Kathleen, and I still hold what I call an insurance position. But for me, that's practically nothing compared to what I had on a month and a half ago. Gold stopped making new highs. It started to show signs of, to me, of internal weakness. Too many people got too heavily involved. And I think gold is having a very strong and I think a healthy making correction that probably still has some distance to carry upon the downside. I think you can get gold all the way down without too much difficulty to 1270. At that point, there'll be great wailing and gnashing of teeth. The people who had been bullish will be throwing their arms up and tossing it overboard. The margin clerks will be having their way. The bears and gold will be joyous in the streets, and probably around 1270 is a good point at which to be a buyer. It's we're down from almost $1,430, $38 an ounce if I'm correct. And here you are trading at 1320. I think you have another $50 on the downside, and that'll make it healthy.
I always want to see someone gnash their teeth. I don't know if I ever have.
Gnashing of teeth, isn't it?
Yes. Anyway.
And rending their clothes.
Yes. Will other commodities outperform gold this year?
I think so. I think that's exactly what's going on. I think the world is beginning to understand that the demand for food is stronger than is the demand for gold. It always should be that way. It's easier for me to think in those terms and think of it in these terms. In the course of the past month, the numbers of bushels of wheat that it takes to buy an ounce of gold has moved in wheat's favor. It has the numbers of bushels have actually fallen, and I think that that's likely to continue. I'm bullish of the gold market generally, but I'm not one of these people who thinks the world's coming to an end and that there's some great conspiracy and that we're all going into the dinger and that gold's going to $5,000 an ounce. I think that's preposterous.
Okay.
I think one would do well to err upon the side, if one is bullish of commodities, to buy the things that you eat, not the things that you drop on your foot.
Which precious metal will see the most gains? Why?
That's a good question. Probably silver, if it has to. I don't trade silver. I don't have the courage to trade silver. I'm an old dog. I'd much rather trade gold. It's quieter. It's less volatile. But all things being equal, the fundamentals are probably better for silver.
Okay.
It has some industrial use. It is a precious metal. And if the global economy continues to strengthen, which I think that it shall, the white precious metals will probably outperform the yellow precious metal. But the volatility of the white precious metals, palladium, platinum, and silver, just frightens me too much.
Copper is consolidating so far in 2011.
Yes.
What's the next big move, up or down?
Probably higher, isn't it? It's here we are. We're getting close to $4.50, and looks to me like we're probably heading higher. I once said that I didn't think when we had copper down at less than $2. I said, I don't think we'll ever get copper above $4 in my lifetime. Well, I'm still alive, and here we are.
Mm-hmm.
We're probably still going higher. The trend is still up, and it is the industrial commodity, isn't it?
Broadly, looking at the dollar index, is it going to hold around 78? I have to admit, this is a listener question. And what's the upside and downside risk?
It's interesting when you talk about the dollar. Most people, when they think, what's the dollar going to do, they're worried about the dollar versus the euro. I actually think dollar index could go sideways for a year, but you could have material moves. I still think you could have the dollar get demonstrably weaker relative to the Aussie and the Canadian dollars. I think you could have the dollar get demonstrably stronger relative to the yen, and I think you could have the dollar get modestly stronger relative to the euro, which will leave the dollar index doing very little.
Okay, what about oil? Will the uptrend line from the August lows hold around $86 a barrel? And again, upside and downside risks.
Well, isn't it interesting what's going on in the oil market? It used to be that you could say, when you were talking about oil, whether you were talking about West Texas Intermediate or Brent, made no difference. They moved one with the other almost in perfect tandem. Now you have material weakness in WTI, the crude oil that is predominantly traded here in the United States, and yet the uptrend line in Brent is extant. Brent keeps making new highs. The Brent WTI spread, normally Brent trades at about $1 to $1.50, even $2 under West Texas Intermediate, is now $11 over West Texas Intermediate. I think the losses that have been incurred by speculators and by those in the trade who didn't think that Brent could ever go to a premium to West Texas, certainly didn't think it would ever go to $2, couldn't believe it would ever make it to $5, and here we are approaching $12 Brent over WTI. So you have to be careful. Which crude do you mean? I hope that we find some support. I bet we find some support in West Texas somewhere around $85, but I'm not willing to put my money at risk to put that to test.
You know, broadly speaking, commodities, many people used to say commodities, that's not an asset class, right? And now it seems like it's obviously a bigger market all the time. And one of the reasons is, of course, there's Mary Coy, who's been on the show, Wolf International Advisors, worked for Cargill many years, has made the point, Dennis, about the financialization of commodities. And when I hear that, I think, yuck, oh, you know, careful, everybody, this market could become much more volatile and dangerous.
Yes.
The argument is, oh, China's growing, India's growing. Buy commodities, everybody, right? I mean, what's your word to the wise here?
My word to the wise is, one, commodities ain't no asset class. They're not stocks. They're not bonds. They are things to trade, and that's it. And the fundamentals that drive commodities are different than those that drive stocks. The general trend on stocks is all, you know, over broad periods of time is from the lower left to the upper right, but not that way in the commodity market. You have to be as amenable and as ready to be short of the commodity markets as you are to be a buyer of it. And when I see the public coming into the market, they are almost always on the long, involved with the long-only funds, the buyers of wheat, the buyers of corn. There will be times, and those times are many, when one has to trade commodities bearishly. So don't think that commodities are an asset class. People are being more involved in them. They are far more on the everyone's radar screen, but you can't just be a buyer. You have to be prepared to be a short almost as often as you are prepared to be a buyer of them.
And that's a lot of work for most people.
That's a lot of work for most people. Most people just don't have the interest, the urge to ever trade anything from the short side. But if you're going to trade commodities, you better get versed in the ability to be short.
Dennis Gartman, such a delight to have you on the show today. Thanks so much.
Kathleen, always my honor. Thanks for asking me.
Okay, Dennis Gartman. He is editor of the Gartman Letter.
You can subscribe to Bloomberg's premium podcast service at Bloomberg.com/Tom Keen and listen to the Hayes Advantage weekdays at noon Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on satellite radio, Sirius Channel 130 and XM Channel 129. Copyright 2011 Bloomberg LP.